Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which we are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is November 22nd, Sunday, 2009, and Bill Fink is here for the fourth installment of Germany and the Jewish Problem by Dr. F.K. Wiebe. How are you doing today, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Yes,
is this only
Yahweh.
The fourth installment? It seems like more than that, but that's okay.
This
is probably the fourth installment.
Well, we did three with Hitler and Christianity out of Mein Kampf, and now we're on the fourth one of Wiebe.
Right, we should probably do three more with Hitler and Christianity, because some people still don't get it. That's a damn shame.
All right.
Jews in the German press, that's where we are, right?
Yes.
And we could draw a lot of parallels to the American press for the last 100 years, too, but we'll start with Germany. Do you want to start this off?
Oh, okay. I was wondering if maybe you wanted to.
No, go ahead. I know what you're going to read.
Jews have always possessed a special aptitude for journalism and the organization of press work. Accordingly, they played a prominent part in the establishment of German newspapers. Hardly any other function has given them so much power as their influence on the press. They soon proved, however, that they had little or no interest in that sense of high moral obligation which is the duty of those who are responsible for influencing public opinion. On the contrary, their interests were primarily centered in the rich possibilities for material gain. If one examines the Jewish-controlled German press of the last decade, one realizes that for purely material reasons, it served a craving for sensation, for vanity, and the lower instincts of the masses. Circulation was increased in proportion as newspapers undermined in the most grave manner all respect for morals, law, and order. The two largest German newspaper concerns were before 1933 in Jewish hands, Ullstein and Mose. Both these firms were founded by Jews, and their directorates and editorial staff were comprised of nearly all Jews.
Now I take offense to Jews have always possessed a special aptitude for journalism, and it's probably the first time I take offense at Wiebe in this whole book. They don't have an aptitude for journalism. They have an aptitude for smut. And the shame of it is that people love smut. The average person, no, whether he's a Christian or an atheist, people buy smut and they buy scandal. And that's
so,
what the Jews have an aptitude for.
He should say smut masquerading as journalism.
Yeah, that's what I believe. Because, I mean, some of the greatest real journalists have been non-Jews. I mean, the few shining stars, and there are only a few. The William Randolph Hearst, I don't think he was a Jew. And he was, you know, the father of yellow journalism, basically, but Pulitzer definitely was. I don't know if you have anything on Hearst. You might know more about him than I do, but I don't think he was a Jew.
I tend to suspect he was, just because his one granddaughter, Patty Hearst, wound up so enthralled with her captors and the SLA.
To me, that's the curse that a lot of liberal families suffer, and a lot of wealthy non-Jewish families even suffer kids that are just losers, that just grow up absolutely corrupt, that the money and the liberalism and the schools have absolutely corrupted them. I don't know. Hearst is a question mark to me. I don't know enough about the man. But he was one of the biggest journalists. However, the Jews did, and we'll find this out a little later, control the New York Times from 1895. I think that was Otto Ox, Salzberger, too. That name sounds familiar. And Jews controlled the New York Times from 1895, and they controlled the Washington Post from the time of the Great Depression.
Okay, here's one strike against William Randolph Hearst. His mother was Phoebe Apperson Hearst, an American philanthropist, a feminist, a suffragist, and she left her Christian faith that she was raised in to push the Bahá'í faith. You know the Bahá'í?
Yeah, well, that sounds all kind of strange for sure. But
and this was going on back in the 1800s, and typically people that crazy, they're not, you know, they're not one of us.
It quite often works out that way, I would have to say. But it's not a guarantee that his blood was polluted. It's she was actually raised a Presbyterian, which might drive anybody nuts. No, I'm kidding. Joseph Pulitzer and the New York Times and the Washington Post has been controlled by Jews from the very beginning, and we'll find that out. But I think that Jews mostly just that they know to cater to smut, and they know what sells, and smut and scandal and sensationalism sell, and real journalism and scholarly treatises are boring and don't sell.
So it's basically muckraking, what was called yellow journalism.
Right. In that aspect, it's a natural for the Jews. It's just a natural because they are the dregs of society, and they know how to cater to them. They're the panderers of history. Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf on page 40, and I'm not going to read all this. It's very long. I have a file on my Mein Kampf site right now, Adolf Hitler and the Jewish press. Under the discussion section on the menu that I'll be using parts of for tonight's program. But Adolf Hitler on page 40 actually started to explain that his own awakening to the Jewish press happened when he observed the way various Jewish newspapers treated various German politicians. And from pages 42 to 44 of Mein Kampf, he does an excellent, I think it's excellent, an excellent expose on the Jewish press and its mechanizations. And I saw that when I was reading this, Mein Kampf, I was reading it for the first time during the Obama, Clinton, McCain, during the presidential runoff, the primaries and the presidential race. And everything I was reading about the press in Mein Kampf, I was hearing on the radio, on AM talk radio. They were doing the same thing that Hitler was explaining that they do, and it was incredible. It was a real it was very illuminating to me to read Hitler's words concerning the press while that election was going on. It was incredible to me. And here on pages 139 to 140 of Mein Kampf, he says that the function of the so-called liberal press was, and this is during World War I he's talking, was to dig the grave for the German people and the Reich. No mention needs to be made of the lying Marxist press. To them, the spreading of falsehood is as much a vital necessity as the mouse is to a cat. Their sole task is to break the national backbone of the people, thus preparing the nation to become slaves of international finance and its masters, the Jews. And that is that not what we saw during Vietnam?
That's exactly what they did.
That's exactly what they did. And they did it in Germany during World War I.
They sent our people to war. And then on the home front, they did everything they could to undermine the war and assure that the war was going to end in defeat.
Absolutely. On page 102 on Marxism, Hitler says, Marxism's final objective was and is and will continue to be the destruction of all non-Jewish national states. Isn't that what the Jewish press does? They hate nationalism, whether it's nationalism in Britain, nationalism in France, nationalism in America. The Jewish press rails against it. But when it's nationalism in Palestine and you're a Jew, you're a hero. Don't Christians see that?
In fact, there are well-organized communist parties in Israel, but none of them have staged a Bolshevik revolution, and they haven't massacred people in the streets. There's been no 1919 Bavarian Soviet Republic in Israel.
Well, no, there won't be, because all those Jewish gangsters over there that stole, raped, and looted and pillaged billions of dollars from Christian nations, they're not going to be willing to give up their money without a fight.
So communism is something they only preach when they're in a host nation, not when they're amongst their own.
Absolutely, because look at what happened in Russia during communism.
Basically,
a Jewish regime ruled Russia for, and Stalin was a Jew, and people might want to argue about this, but they're just ignorant. Stalin was a Jew, and a Jewish regime ruled Russia probably up through the time of Khrushchev, and Jews still had much influence during the Khrushchev years. When the Soviet system fell apart, 10 or 12 Jews walked away with the wealth of the nation, didn't they? The oligarchs. They're called the oligarchs.
For the Jew, communism is for what, the cult leader mass suicide would be. The cult leader tells everyone to take your cyanide pill, and he'll join you, but you go ahead and do it first.
Absolutely.
The Jews never have any intention of practicing communism amongst themselves.
All right, so Weeby talks about two of the biggest newspapers and some of the biggest newspapers and publishers in Germany during World War I. And the first one he mentions is Ullstein Publishers and Printers. The circulation of this largest newspaper concern averaged 4 million daily. They published 5 large daily newspapers, several weekly newspapers, and many periodicals and magazines of every description. The Ullstein News Agency influenced a great number of provincial papers. Now, doesn't that sound like AP and UPI today?
Absolutely.
How they basically write the news for all the local papers and decide what they see and what they don't see?
And who are they, really? I mean, does anyone really know a whole lot about them? It seems like they're just some faceless international entity that decides what you're going to read and what you're not going to read.
Well, that's what they are. That's what AP is, that's what UPI is, and that's what Reuters is. And sometimes, they're minor reporters. We see their names in the paper. But the average person does not know that his local newspaper gets almost all of its non-local news through either AP or UPI. And these are just faceless maggots sitting on Wall Street deciding what we're going to see and what we're not going to see.
Why would I need internationalists that don't even live in my county to tell me what my county news is?
And it's pretty much an accepted fact that all the news coming from Europe up through the time of World War II and even through the 50s came through Reuters. And nothing that didn't come through Reuters hit the United States. It all came through Reuters. So everything that we think we know about Europe in World War II from our newspaper accounts came through Reuters, which is absolutely incredible. The whole of the shares of this vast concern, I'm back to the Ullstein Publishers and Printers in Germany in World War I, the whole of the shares in this vast concern were held by the 5 Jewish Ullstein brothers. The directorate consisted of these brothers, 3 other Jews, and only 2 Christians. So I guess the Jews have their token Christians.
And we don't even really know if they were if they were just Jews practicing Christianity.
Absolutely. You want to read the next session? Well, the largest newspaper issued by this concern was the Berliner Morgenpost. That's the morning paper, which had a larger circulation than any other German paper, more than 600,000 daily. Besides a Jewish editor, this paper had, in 1927, 10 other Jews as members of the editorial staff. The editorial staff of the Vossische Zeitung, an extremely influential political organ, was in charge of the Jew George Bernard and 14 Jewish sub-editors. Bernard at that time was keen on making a name for himself in politics. The position in regard to the remaining Ullstein papers was practically the same. Now we see this is only one company and there's more here, but I want to read another quote from Mein Kampf, page 57. And when we read this and we see the control that the Jews have over our newspapers, here's Adolf Hitler. By far, the most effective branch of political education, which in this connection is best expressed by the word propaganda, is carried on by the press. The press is the chief means employed in the process of political enlightenment. It represents a kind of school for adults. This educational activity, however, is not in the hands of the state, but in the clutches of the powers, which are partly of a very inferior character. And he's talking about the Jews, of course. And Adolf Hitler understood that most adult people got all of their continuing education, you know, anything they learned after they left school, from the press. And it's, you know, I ask people all the time today if they learned, yeah, you know, the people that want to debate with me about Christianity and history, one of the first things I ask them is if they learned everything they think they know from CNN and USA Today. Because it's true. People don't read books. They read the paper. They listen to the news. Very, very few people actually, when they read books, they read pulp novels. Very few people actually read real books written by real people. It's incredible.
Sometimes they'll read a book about so-and-so, but it's written by some Jewish biographer.
Hitler,
that's
says
basically
on
the extent of it.
Yeah, absolutely. A Jewish biographer about a goyim, and the Jew has no respect for him except to make some money off him, off his name. Page 57, Mein Kampf. Whatever definition we may give of the term public opinion, only a very small part of it originates from personal experience or individual insight. He knew that people got all of their opinions from the press. He goes on to say the greater portion of it results from the manner in which public matters have been presented to the people through an overwhelmingly impressive and persistent system of information. Every fool has an opinion, and a few people have informed opinions, would be my addendum to that.
So basically the Jew uses persistent lies in the press to just overwhelm people.
Absolutely.
To the point where since they've been exposed to it for so long, they think it must be true, and they think it's their opinion because it is true. Well, why do you believe in that? Because it's true.
You want to read about Moss? Moss Publishers, the second largest publishing firm in Germany?
All right. This firm was, as far as size is concerned, not so important as Ullstein. Its daily circulation was 350,000. Established and maintained as a family concern by the Eastern Jew, Rudolf Moss, formerly Moses, its influence was none the less very great. Its chief publication was the Berliner Tageblatt, established long before 1933. It was this paper which for many years was looked upon abroad as representative of German public opinion. Isn't this much the same way how in America they consider the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune to be representative of American public opinion?
Absolutely. And the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal.
Despite the fact that these papers are totally out of touch with mainstream middle America, aren't they?
They're absolutely out of touch with mainstream America. That they are run by the most humanist, most leftist Jews that you could possibly find in journalism school.
But if some foreigner, say somebody in Jordan or Lebanon, were to read the New York Times and think that that is representative of American public opinion and popular thought, they would think that we're basically culturally a Scandinavian liberal banana case of a nation, and that we're also jingoistic and warmongering, and we have a desire to obliterate all the Muslim nations.
Absolutely. And that's that they right, that those papers are perceived as being the light of the nation all the time. It's incredible. And the Wall Street, you know, the Wall Street Journal, I know that the last two, well, I can't quite remember, Brett Schundler or the current edit, you know, the head of the editorial page for the Wall Street Journal, his last job was with the Jerusalem Post. Brett Stevens. Brett Stevens. And that sounds like an innocent enough Anglo name, Brett Stevens. But he's a Jew, and his last job was as an editor for the Jerusalem Post. And the head of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal before him was Dorothy Rabinowitz. Guess what she was?
Palestinian.
And these people are seen as the leading lights of the nation. They're the opinion makers. And no matter where you turn, they're Jews. It's incredible.
And they're considered the spokesman for America, aren't they?
Right. And the best defense a Christian has is to know, as the scripture tells us, that when a Jew moves his lips, he's lying. And we shouldn't give them any credence at all. And we should sure as hell never buy a newspaper put out by a Jew. But they've been hiding behind names like the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Detroit Free Press. They've been hiding behind these Saxon American-sounding names and these noble-sounding names, and they've been pumping vile crap into our heads for over 100 years now.
Even some of the ones in local small town America, my dad's hometown, there's one person that always, he's an editor, I think his name is Liebfeld, or what an Anglo-Saxon name, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, absolutely, sure.
All right, then should I,
you
the editor,
move on with Weeby?
All right, the editor of this paper was the Jew Theodore Wolff, who also took a prominent part in politics. Apart from him, the important positions on the editorial staff were filled by 17 other Jews. In 5 important capitals outside the Reich, the Berlin Tageblatt was represented by Jews. And then he goes on to talk about how they have similar influence in the so-called freelance associations, and I'd just like to read one paragraph out of there. Finally, the official organization of freelance, quote-unquote, German writers, the Schutzverband Deutscher Schriftsteller, was controlled by a directorate which in 1928 and 1929 consisted of 90% Jews. Its president was at that time the Jewish publicist Arnold Zweig, author of the war novel Streit den Zergarten Grisha, in which he foully besmirched the national honor of the German people.
Well, absolutely. That's what their novels do.
But even the so-called freelance, 90% Jewish, and these are supposed to be freelance.
And it's absolutely amazing. But Jewish literature, literature produced by Jews, might sound American enough or German enough or English enough, but it really aims at portraying Americans and Englishmen and Germans as in the worst possible light, portraying Christians in the worst possible light that the Jews can get away with at any one time, and pulling apart our culture. And destroying our culture in the minds of all of their readers.
Well, and Hitler pointed out... Oh, sorry, go on. I was going to say, Hitler pointed out that with regards to propaganda in World War I, the Germans like to be fair and give everything an objective and assessment, and they say, well, who's to blame for the war breaking out? Maybe we shoulder some of the blame, but certainly the Russians, the Serbs, and the English and the French, they have to have their share. And he said that the English were united behind the opinion that it was definitely the Germans. The English had nothing to do with it, and they laid the blame squarely at the feet of their enemy, the Germans. And it seems that Americans, we like to be objective. We like to be open to criticizing ourselves if we have flaws and faults. So the Jew writes a novel where he explores, where he says he's going to explore the experience of a soldier. And Americans think it'll be some good and some bad and mostly realistic. And then it just winds up being, you know, dragging the honor of the nation through the mud. They tear us down. And it's just criticism after criticism, flaw after flaw. And they basically make a mockery of our values.
Absolutely. That's what they've done, and it's been systematic for well over 100 years now. I'd like to read from Mein Kampf again, and this might be a little long, and I apologize, but I just feel that it has to be said. This is pages, it's from page 42 through 44. Adolf Hitler's really talking about his own awakening to the Jewish problem in being in control of our media. What soon gave me cause for very serious consideration were the activities of the Jews in certain branches of life, into the mystery of which I penetrated little by little. Was there any shady undertaking, any form of foulness, especially in cultural life, and at least one Jew did not participate? On putting the probing knife carefully to that kind of abscess, one immediately discovered, like a maggot in a putrescent body, a little Jew who is often blinded by the sudden light. In my eyes, the charge against Judaism became a grave one the moment I discovered the Jewish activities in the press, in art, in literature, and in the theater, which we're going to get into here shortly. All un-Jewish protests were now more or less futile. One needed only to look at the posters announcing the hideous productions of the cinema and the theater and study the names of the authors who were highly lauded there in order to become permanently adamant on Jewish questions. Here was a pestilence, a moral pestilence, with which the public was being infected. We are way past infection. It was worse than the Black Plague of long ago. And in what mighty doses this poison was manufactured and distributed. Naturally, the lower the moral and intellectual level of such an author of artistic products, the more inexhaustible his fecundity. Sometimes it went so far that one of these fellows, acting like a sewage pump, would shoot his filth directly in the face of other members of the human race. In this connection, we must remember there is no limit to the number of such people. That describes Hollywood today perfectly. One ought to realize that for one Goethe, nature may bring into existence 10,000 such despoilers who act as the worst kind of germ carriers in poisoning human souls. It was terribly thought, and yet it could not be avoided, that the greater number of Jews seemed specially destined by nature to play this shameful part. And is it for this reason that they then can be called the chosen people? I think that's describing Hollywood in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, at any time in modern American history. Adolf Hitler is perfectly describing Hollywood. And our television, especially lately. That's all they do is they pump, that they consistently, like sewage pumps, shoot filth all over our society. And we permit it. And most of us like it. It's incredible. And we buy it up. I'm going to go on for another paragraph. And I began to investigate carefully the names of all the fabricators of these unclean products in public cultural life. The result of that inquiry was still more disfavorable to the attitude which I had hitherto held in regard to the Jews. Though my feelings might rebel 1,000 times, reason now had to draw its own conclusions. The fact that 9/10 of all the smutty literature, artistic tripe, and theatrical banalities had to be charged to the account of people who formed scarcely 1% of the nation, that fact could not be gainsaid. It was there and had to be admitted. Then I began to examine my favorite world press with that fact before my mind. And he found the same thing all throughout the media. That's the whole point of Hitler's chastising of the Jewish media, is that all they produce is filth and destruction of the country.
I'd like to point out one thing here that I was reading out of Mein Kampf. Page 108, it was, for example, a fundamental mistake to ridicule the worth of the enemy, as the Austrian and German comic papers made a chief point of doing in their propaganda. The very principle here is a mistaken one, for when they came face to face with the enemy, our soldiers had quite a different impression. Therefore, the mistake had disastrous results. Once the German soldier realized what a tough enemy he had to fight, he felt that he had been deceived by the manufacturers of the information which had been given him. Therefore, instead of strengthening and stimulating his fighting spirit, this information had quite the contrary effect. Finally, he lost heart. On the other hand, British and American war propaganda was psychologically efficient. By picturing the Germans to their own people as barbarians and Huns, they were preparing their soldiers for the horrors of war and safeguarding them against illusions. The most horrific weapons which those soldiers encountered in the field merely confirmed the information that they had already received, and their belief in the truth of the assertions made by their respective governments was accordingly reinforced. And I'd like to point out that our government basically saying that we're fighting Stone Age pajama-wearing cavemen in Afghanistan and peasants in Iraq, despite the fact that they're very cunning and resourceful, they are preparing our people for a shock and then a letdown, aren't they?
Well, you know, that's a way of It's a way of destroying the will of the people, is to tear down the enemy, make him look like nothing, and when he turns out to be formidable, your zealousness is just destroyed. The zeal and the confidence on your side is destroyed. And the Jews used the Tet Offensive in Vietnam for that reason. The Tet Offensive failed in every way on the North Vietnamese side. It was a miserable failure. Yet, just because they launched it, the Jewish press here in America made it look like a great success for the North Vietnamese. And it destroyed the will of the people to fight the war.
Isn't that what they always do?
That's
they were
what
doing
they
it
always
it,
do, right.
They were doing it back
really,
in World War I.
They're really just parasites that want to destroy the host. Because when nations fall apart, Jews profit. They profit immensely. During the Great Depression, they bought up huge tracts of our property. When I say property, I don't mean real estate. I mean stocks, bonds, mortgages, shares in companies. That they bought up huge portions of it at fire sale prices. That's what they do. And that's what they did in post-war Germany, as we've already seen here. You want to proceed with Weeby?
All right. Would you like to real quick? I'm being booted out of talk, so I'm going to try and get back in.
Okay. In the critical weeks, and I'm back to Dr. Weeby and Germany and the Jewish problem. In the critical weeks before the signing of the Versailles Treaty, when the German people and its leaders well nigh unanimously rejected the intolerable and harsh conditions of that dictated peace, he made common cause, he meaning the Jew in the press, he made common cause with those really comparatively few men of public influence who, through the medium of the spoken and printed word, ruthlessly suppressed every flickering of the spirit of national resistance, and thereby destroyed all hopes of securing more bearable conditions. In other words, the press portrays to the general public the options and the inevitable outcomes, and when the general public tend to believe them from the press, it's sort of like rolls a ball in motion that can't be stopped, and that's that the Jew steers the country through that public opinion that he's able to influence. And this is what Dr. Weeby is explaining happened in the closing weeks of World War I. One requires only to glance at the old issues of the Vossische Zeitung, a German newspaper controlled by Jews, for those weeks and months to realize how systematically Bernard, who was the Jewish publisher, went about this work. Even the most humiliating terms of this treaty, the war guilt clause, he attempted to represent as mere bagatelle. He wrote to give one example on June 18, 1919, Bernard wrote, "The German reader of the note will most easily be able to reconcile himself with those parts which deal with the historical origin of the war and with the question of the guilt for it. If one regards the matter in this manner, one cannot take the scolding in the war guilt paragraph tragically." In other words, the Jewish press convinced the German people that they started World War I. That's what we'd be saying here.
The audacity to make such a bold-faced lie.
It's absolutely a bold-faced lie.
Yet he asserts it as a truth as easily as a person would tell something that is true.
Absolutely. And you know, Hitler goes on for many pages in Mein Kampf and in various sections and shows that it was the Jewish press that was mainly responsible for costing Germany the First World War.
Well, did they not organize the munition strike at the critical moment?
Well, yes, there was an organized munition strike, and the press played that up. and a munition strike really was by itself, and Hitler explains that the munition strike by itself really was not that critical.
Yes,
but
in fact,
it broke the will of the people, and the press used it as the final straw that broke the camel's back.
To quote him, he said, "The munition strike, however, did not bring the final success that had been hoped for, namely to starve the front of ammunition. It lasted too short a time for the lack of ammunition as such to bring disaster to the army as was originally planned, but the moral damage was much more terrible. In the first place, what was the army fighting for if the people at home did not wish it to be victorious? For whom then were these enormous sacrifices and privations being made and endured? Must the soldiers fight for victory while the home front goes on strike against it?"
Absolutely.
Isn't it basically what happened in Vietnam as well?
Absolutely. That's exactly what happened in Vietnam, time and again. The Jews perfected it in World War I Germany. And on pages 101 and 102, talking about World War I, Hitler explains early victories that the Germans achieved and how the Jewish press, as in his words, began to throw cold water drip by drip on the enthusiasm of the public by downplaying the victories and expressing them as
they said that it was improper and it wasn't befitting for a great people to be so jubilant over a victory in war, because they said war was a terrible thing and not to be celebrated, even if victorious.
And that's the same attitude that they present here. That's the same attitude they presented here after we were successful in Iraq. Not that I agree with the Iraq war by any means, but that's the attitude that the press presented.
It's gradualism. They undermine us by telling us we shouldn't celebrate our victories, and then before you know it, we're celebrating our defeats.
Absolutely. And that's what they do. And they are amazingly effective at controlling the minds of the people. And it's that the people... They read all these newspapers and believe what they read. They listen to CNN and believe what they see and believe what they hear.
I believe it was Sumner Redstone who was quoted as saying, "We don't simply tell 13 and 14-year-olds how they should live or how they should behave. We own them."
Right, and they do. They absolutely do. Because 13 and 14-year-olds today are, and probably for the last 30 years, absolutely raised by television. And all of their opinions, their basic opinions about life and their outlook on life, their Weltanschauung, is formed by Seinfeld and all of those other Jewish perverts, Adam Sandler, on television and in the movie.
They could tell you the plot to 30 different episodes of Seinfeld, but they couldn't name four of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and they probably couldn't name their great-great-grandparents.
And that's, you know something? I experienced many, many times the average American man not knowing what nationality he was, not knowing the names of his own grandparents, their last names. It's absolutely incredible. And that's true. That's actually a pretty good analogy.
So they've basically filled their head, rather than filling it with nothing, which would be preferable, they filled it with crap. So, you know, if you're going to either know something that's worthless or just know nothing at all, it would be far preferable if they knew nothing, if they were just a blank slate, but instead they're tainted, they're a corrupted slate. Their head is filled with slop. As Hitler said, it's like it was, you know, a sewage pump. It seems like their mind was filled with a sewer pump.
Well, that's exactly the words Hitler just used in Mein Kampf on pages 40 to 42, well, 42 to 44. That's precisely what they do.
It was filled with a Jewish sewage pump.
That's every television, every movie theater, at every just about, you know, 99% of the stuff on the radio, and it is every one of those. You could picture them as a Jewish sewer pump, and that's exactly true. That's exactly what they are. I have no doubt.
All right, would you like to continue with Weebie, or shall I?
You can.
I move ahead to Theodor Wolff, the editor of the Berliner Tageblatt, behaved in a different but equally objectionable manner.
an apparently convinced monarchist during the war, there was, after the change of the constitution in Germany, no one who reviled and slandered the deposed Hohenzollerns in so evil a manner as Wolf. And just as an aside, the Hohenzollerns were the family of monarchs in Germany. The Kaiser Wilhelm was a Hohenzollern.
Yeah, they were the Habsburgs. I'm sorry, Kaiser Wilhelm. Yeah, the Hohenzollerns. You're right. Mm. I'm sorry.
Even if we could forgive him such opportunism, quite inexcusable is his behavior at the time when the increasing spread of indecency and immorality in Germany forced the government in 1926 to take constitutional steps for the suppression of filthy and otherwise low-grade literature. The intention was above all to protect youth from coarsening and indecent influences. Theodore Wolff openly opposed this effort. He condemned the new law and, as a protest, resigned from the Democratic Party, which he had helped to found because they had supported the new measure. In order to understand the whole frivolous irresponsibility of this Jewish publicist, one must know just how far the flooding of the German book and periodicals market with dirty pornographic productions had gone. We shall have more to say about this later on. Still more influential than Georg Bernard and Theodore Wolff, certainly the mightiest man of the pen which Germany had for a generation, was Maximilian Harden, a brother of Witten, the previously mentioned Jewish defeatist. With his periodical Die Zukunft, The Future, he indulged in high politics for more than 20 years. Hardly any other man has shown so much fluctuation in character and principle as he. He began by setting himself up as the judge of morality in Imperial Germany and dealt a death blow to the reputation of the monarchic system by his journalistic scandal-mongering about the Hohenzollern court. During the Great War, he was certainly the only real annexationist in Germany, demanding as the price of victory the whole of Belgium, the French coast opposite England, and the Congo Basin. That's from Weidi Zukunft, October 17, 1914. Then when the fortunes of war in 1916 began to turn away from Germany, Harden also retreated. He attacked German war policy and began an enthusiastic admirer of President Wilson. In 1919, he finally conducted a cowardly campaign against the national resistance to the tyrannical peace treaty terms, naming this resistance, quote, artificially forced hysteria and miserable falsehood. The driving forces of such characterless behavior were vanity and petty selfish ambition. Harden is rightly described by the world-renowned historian Friedrich Thieme as, quote, the Judas of the German people. And I would like to point out, the Talmud teaches, quote, ally yourself with him upon whom fate smiles at the moment. Is that any surprise? The Jews really have no allies, do they? They just have people that are useful at the moment.
Absolutely. They have no friends except the dollar and no allies except the dollar and the gold and the silver, and they don't care about anything else.
And as evidenced by the Bolshevik Revolution, they will eat their own to advance their own personal agenda.
I wouldn't doubt, you know, Hitler and a lot of somebody's asking in the forum if the Habsburg had Jewish blood, and I wouldn't doubt it, because a lot of the German and Austrian nobility had – And even the Prussian nobility had been intermarrying with Jewish merchants for ever since maybe around the time of the French Revolution.
Well, I think that the Austrians, they started making Jews nobles before any other country. The Austrians probably were intermixing with the Jews at least in the mid-1600s. I would think the 30 Years' War really brought that out. The Habsburg Empire was basically the first one to be totally contaminated, corrupted, and rotten at a core, aside from the Portuguese, which never really amounted to anything anyway.
It's very likely that the later Habsburgs had Jewish blood. Mm. Just like Prince Charles has Jewish blood. A lot of people say Elizabeth does, but I seriously doubt it. But Prince Charles definitely, through the Battenbergs, through the Mountbattens, has Jewish blood. There's no doubt.
I would think if Elizabeth II does, it would be through George IV.
It's often speculated, but I consider it highly unlikely. On the press, what we see, it's clear that the press from Dr. Wiebe and from Adolf Hitler's testimony, the Jewish media was responsible for the control of public opinion amongst the masses of World War I Germany and Weimar Germany. Weimar Germany. And
so
people, you know, we wonder why things in America are so screwed up today. And I have a file on my Mein Kampf website, my mk.christogenia.org. And it's this file's been around for a long time. It's I think it originally came from National Vanguard, and it's facts of Jewish media control, and it's a little dated. I mean, some of these people are retired now. The article's probably about 10 years old. I left the title on it. It's on my discussion menu, and it shows the incredible amount of Jews in control of American media. And our media and entertainment industry is headed by 90% Jews. It's incredible.
I think this article is only 4 or 5 years old. I think I remember when it came out in 2004.
Okay, it might be, but I know that some of these people are retired. Michael Eisner of Disney. Yeah, you mentioned Sumner Redstone earlier, and he's the chairman and chief executive of Viacom. That they own a lot of media outlets, and they also own a lot of like Simon and Schuster. They publish our school books. That these same media outlets publish all our school. They own all the publishing companies now, Simon and Schuster and Grolier and all the old big publishing companies of school books, Scholastic. That they all sold out to the major media outlets.
Oh, and for those who don't recognize the name Sumner Redstone, he was born Murray Rothstein.
Yeah, Redstone is Rothstein. It's a, you know, Rothstein is Redstone in German, and his real name is Murray Rothstein, and he's a Jew. But I mean, this problem's nagged. It's from the 60s. It's been prevalent. They've cornered just about our entire media. I don't know how Ted Turner slipped through the cracks. I'm sorry, Ted Turner. He's not a Jew, but he sure as hell thinks like one.
Well, I was going to say we should no longer refer to any sort of American media or German media. We should just simply call it the Jewish media.
Right. We don't have an American media. It hasn't been American in 50 years or better, probably better, because many media outlets were founded by Jews. And like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, that they've been run by Jews for a long, long time, and 120 years in case of the New York Times. But, I mean, CBS was founded by Bill Paley, and his name was William Polinsky, and he's a Jew. And Jews took over the entire movie industry during the Depression.
But they did not found or build Hollywood. They simply came in after the white man did all the actual physical building and all the creative innovation, you know, Thomas Edison and all of his inventions.
Right, D.W. Griffith, Thomas Edison. You know, white men laid all the foundation for Hollywood. The Jews stole Edison's movie invention. They never paid him the patent royalties for the motion picture camera and the film film camera that he invented. And they just stole it and started making movies. And all they produced was smut. But they were tightly controlled through the '50s. A lot of people today don't have any conception that through the 1950s, we had a board that determined what movies, you know, what was allowable in movies and what wasn't.
They snuck in a lot of innuendo quietly, and they had to be subtle about it, though.
Right, but Americans today wouldn't even conceive that at one time there was a board that dictated what was allowable and what wasn't allowable to be shown in movies.
Of course, and certain actors and actresses wind up blacklisted if they engaged in extramarital affairs. They were held to a certain conduct, weren't they?
Well, you know, at one time it was a disgrace even for politicians like Bill Clinton would have resigned. He would have had to resign in the 1930s and 40s and 50s.
Or he would have been impeached.
Absolutely. But most people caught in acts like that, at, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, would resign just because they would want to avoid the disgrace. They'd resign immediately. Even if they weren't guilty, they would resign in many cases. Even if they did nothing wrong and they knew it, they would still resign to avoid the media circus.
And there's certainly been a weakening of public morals, and I would say that this has been the driving force behind this weakening has been the Jew, such that today Bill Clinton is fellationed by a Mossad operative, most likely a Mossad operative, and most kids think it's no big deal, and he's cool for being the president and for getting all that stuff going on, or as they would say, getting his freak on in the Oval Office.
Well, yeah, and we have a Negro culture now. There's no doubt, and it's the Jews that have done it. It's the Jewish media that's done it.
Well, isn't that what Hitler said, that they were bringing Negroes into the Rhineland for, to bastardize the blood of the German people? We already had Negroes in this country. They just had to remove the legal and societal cultural barriers. So now they can bastardize the blood, and they're bastardizing the culture. In fact, they've already bastardized the culture. There is no more American culture anymore.
Well, I don't know if there was an American culture in the 1950s.
Mm.
The whole doo-wop thing, that's not American. That's a Negro culture. Chuck Berry, that crap, that's not American.
At one time, we had an Anglo-Nordic American culture.
And most of the doo-wop, to me, I mean, I identify that with the Jews of Brooklyn before I identify it with anybody else. Most of the 50s music. To me, I identify that right with the Jews of Brooklyn. You want to start with Jews in German art and literature?
Oh, absolutely. This is going to be good.
Okay. I have to admit being, I'm culturally challenged. I don't know much about cinema, arts, literature. I just don't, and I didn't bone up for this program.
Abstract art is lost on you. You can't decipher what the artist was trying to convey with the beautiful painting.
Oh, yeah, right. Like, I could take a roller and just slap it around a room and call it abstract art.
Mm-hmm. Or I'll just let my cat dunk his paws in a little bucket of paint, and he'll walk around on the canvas, and that'll be my painting.
It'll probably sell.
It'll be an original sword, brother, and the asking price is just a mere $1 million.
You got to put a burger of steen on the end of that.
Sword brother Mon.
Okay.
Jews in German art and literature. Many years before the National Socialist regime, indeed even before the war and prior to the period when Jewish emancipation had reached its climax, anxious observers pointed out that cultural life in Germany hardly deserved the epithet of German anymore, and that it had actually become a merely Jewish sphere of activity. The crisis in German cultural life has never been more aptly described, and the Jewish problem has never been discussed in clearer terms than in the article by the Jewish essayist Moritz Goldstein, already published as early as 1912 in Kunstwort, issue dated March 1912, a German art magazine of very high standing. Goldstein depicts how the Jews, at the beginning of their emancipation, generally invaded all branches of German cultural life and, as alert scholars, soon commenced to supplant their masters. Goldstein gives the following synopsis of the consequences resulting from this development. Quote, Jews suddenly filled all those positions which were not withheld from them by force. They have converted German aims and tasks into their own, and they strive for them accordingly. It seems as if German cultural life were to be completely transferred into Jewish hands. This was neither anticipated nor desired by the Christians at the time they granted the pariah in their midst a share in European cultural life. They began to take defensive measures. They resumed their custom of calling us aliens. They commenced to regard us as a danger in the temple of their art. Consequently, we are now faced by the following problem. We Jews guide and administrate the intellectual property of a nation which denies our qualification and competency to do so. So here's a Jew basically griping that since Jews have flooded into the German cultural life and the art, and they've contaminated it, the Goyim are upset about it, and there's a backlash. He's complaining about the backlash, isn't he?
Absolutely. That there's no doubt. Go on.
I was going to say, yet if the art was not a product of a Jewish mind, as Gerald and others so often are fond of saying, if the art wasn't the sort of trash that Egon Schiele and Ernst Ludwig Kirchner come up with, just this filth, this, as Hitler said, the sewage pump trash, there would be no backlash. You know, if Jewish art was anything but Jewish, there wouldn't be a backlash, because all they are capable of doing is smut, trash, and essentially criticisms of the most sacred and the most holy. Like that one character, that Afro-Honduran, I think his name is Savanis, and that Piss Christ of his, that horrible trash, vile. It's blasphemous.
Hitler. Hitler has an odd sense of Jewish art. He in some places he denies that there is Jewish art. On pages 170 to 172, and it's in there. I'd have it in a range. I don't have it from the actual page. In order to form a correct judgment of the place which the Jew holds in relation to the whole problem of human civilization, we must bear in mind the essential fact that there has never been any Jewish art, and consequently that nothing of this kind exists today. He considered all attempts by the Jews at art as a corruption. That they really didn't produce art. They just corrupted what already was. We must realize that, especially in these two royal domains of art, namely architecture and music, the Jew has done no original creative work. When a Jew comes to producing something in the field of art, he merely bowdlerizes something already in existence or simply steals the intellectual work of others. The Jew essentially lacks those qualities which are characteristic of those creative races that are the founders of civilization. No, the Jews have not the creative abilities which are necessary to the founding of a civilization. For them, there is not and never has been a spirit of idealism, which is an absolutely necessary element in the higher development of mankind. Therefore, the Jewish intellect will never be constructive, but always destructive. At best, it may serve as a stimulus in rare cases, but only within meaning of the poet's lines, the power which always wills the bad and always works the good. It is not through his help, but in spite of his help, that mankind makes any progress.
That sounds like dual seed line to me. He understands that the Jews don't have the creative spirit that our people have.
Absolutely. If Hitler was alive today, he would be a two seed line Christian identity pastor. I'm positive. There's no doubt in my mind.
So much for all those Christian bashing so-called Hitlerists, the neo-Nazis.
The Christian bashing Hitlerists and neo are all idiots that have never actually read anything. Everything they think they've learned, again, comes from CNN and Jewish television and movies.
Why would they expect the Jews to give a truthful account of Hitler?
You know, that's absolutely incredible that a Christian or a white man even would trust a Jew at all with anything, with giving a credible account of anything, but especially a Christian. You want to move on with Weeby?
All right. What would you like to read next? Would you like to take over the reading?
Not quite yet, because I'm not sure where you left off. I'm sorry.
Okay. Goldstein describes this Jewish administration and control of German art and culture as a, quote, prodigious fact. A retrospective examination of German intellectual life as it was before 1933 will corroborate Goldstein's testimony. In all spheres, be it on the stage, in literature, music, painting, and the plastic arts, be it in the film or more recently in broadcasting, Jews always occupied the leading positions, compelling all to follow their intellectual guidance. In the domain of literature, the bestsellers were invariably the output of Jewish authors or publishers. Readers abroad who took an interest in German literature during these days will still be able to recall such names as Emil Ludwig, Jakob Wassermann, Arnold Zieg, Leon Zuchtwagner, and various others. The sale of their books outweighed that of all other German authors by far. Statistics have shown that practically the half of all German belletristic literature circulating abroad during the last 10 years was the product of Jewish authors. Music life was similarly dominated by Jewish influence. In the great majority of cases, the important conductors' positions in Berlin and in the provinces were occupied by Jews. The intellectual influence resulting from this trend was decisive for the choice of the works appearing on the programs of opera and concert hall. The participation of Jewish composers grew to astonishing dimensions. Gustav Mahler and Arnold Schoenberg were substituted for Beethoven. Richard Wagner and Hans Pfitzner were supplanted by Franz Schrecker. Music critiques written by Jews and the influence of the professional agencies, which were practically totally in Jewish hands, naturally did their part to support this development. Don't we have this today where
all the original American folk music and any sort of classical, anything that has to do with true culture is supplanted and cast by the wayside to make way for hip-hop, ooga-booga rap, and basically rock and roll.
Absolutely. And the Jew profits from all of it. It's clear to me through observation that the Jewish financial class, not all Jews are financiers, but the Jewish financial class, the record and movie and music producers, and the Jewish media all work in concert to make sure that the Jew controls what we perceive as American pop culture. That
and their goal
music
is
sells, his music gets made, the bands they pick get produced. There's no doubt.
Would you agree that their goal isn't so much to make money as it is to wreck our culture and thus bastardize the blood of our people? That's their ultimate end goal, to wipe our people off the face of the earth.
Well, everything that's of a truly white or a truly Christian culture, like Celtic folk music or American folk music, is belittled. And the only time you hear American folk music is when it suits the purposes of the Jew. And you might hear Bob Dylan or Joan Baez, but you won't hear much more than that.
Isn't Bob Dylan's a Jew, isn't he?
Yes, Bob Dylan's a Jew. And Joan Baez is an alien. I'm not sure what sort. I wouldn't doubt if she wasn't a Ladino or a Hispanic Jew. I'm not positive, but...
All right. The situation was no different with regard to the plastic arts and painting. Jewish art traffic and Jewish art literature paved the way to success for a whole generation of Jewish painters and sculptors, a way which was barred to the majority of German artists. Film and broadcasting were practically exclusively reserved to Jewish activity, so that it is nearly impossible to speak of a German participation in those domains. To destroy any possible doubt as to the accuracy of these statements regarding the Jewish preponderance in German intellectual life, it is merely necessary to revert to the testimony of such a trustworthy Jew as Moritz Goldstein, who already in 1912 made the following observation in the essay quoted above. Nobody actually questions the power the Jews exercise in the press. Criticism in particular, at least as far as the larger towns and their influential newspapers are concerned, seems to be becoming a Jewish monopoly. Predominance of the Jewish element in the theater is also generally recognized. Nearly all the managers of Berlin stages are Jews. The same may be said of a large part, even perhaps of the majority of the actors. Whilst the fact that the concert and theater are dependent upon the Jewish public is continuously being proudly asserted and also deplored, many an apostle of German art has been forced, much against his will, to convince himself of the enormous number of Jews amongst German poets. And I'd like to point out here, I asked my father earlier, I said that the common Jewish counter to what they call the stab in the back myth about the loss in World War I is that, quote, 12,000 Jews gave their lives on the field of honor for the fatherland. And I asked him, I said, even if that was the case, 12,000 out of approximately 2 to 3 million German soldiers who died in the war, that's not even 0.1%, is it? So the Jews, who make up 1% of the population and 90% of stockbrokers, 90% of movie and music directors and producers, make up less than 0.1% of battlefield casualties, if you believe that 12,000 actually did die. And I said that if they're going to make that claim, I would like to see a list of names, because I don't even believe it was 10.
They were probably 12,000 Jews caught stealing supplies from the quartermasters.
And they were shot.
And they were executed.
Or that they were caught in the crossfire. They were trying to flee. Or they were camp followers. They came by the soldiers' camps and tried to pander prostitutes to them, and then artillery barrage would begin, and they'd be killed in the barrage.
Right. Even if 12,000 Jews died in any of those wars, it's when you look at how many Christian Germans died and how many Christian Englishmen died, it's spit in the ocean.
You know, I asked my dad, why is it that if they're 1% of the population and 90% of stockbrokers, why are they never 90% of an infantry unit? They're less than, you know, if you find them in the military, it's always as quartermasters, support personnel, or administrative personnel.
Right. On the rare occasion that they're in the military in wartime, they're usually in a support field. That's
you never see them in the trenches with the mud and the blood.
It's very rare. It's very rare. And it's even if they're 1% of the population of Germany, you would think that they would be 1% of the casualties.
Mm-hmm.
And 12,000 is spit in the ocean. And I seriously doubt if it was that many. I'd rather believe 12,000 of them got caught cattle rustling or something. It's incredible.
All right. This Jewish preponderance was by no means the result of an intellectual superiority of greater talents or creative powers on the part of the Jewish race. On the contrary, it was mainly the Jewish economic ascendancy described above which led to the establishment of their dominant position in German cultural life.
Let's talk about that, because that is the key to everything, is understanding that it is the Jew who is the banker. And when the Jew is the banker, then the Jew is going to get the loans. And another Jew is going to get the seed money or the IPO money in stock sales. It's they favor their own. They always favor their own. And we're stupid as a culture for trying to be racially blind, while the Jew has never, ever, ever been racially blind. And if the Jew's creating the money, then the Jew is going to prevail in everything else in the culture. Well, there is no doubt that that hasn't been the exact pattern that's happened for 400 years now.
My little scribble of notes here is that Jewry is simultaneously an informal network of connections and a criminal cartel. They tell us that we should shun favoritism, while for them, favoritism is the rule of the day. Should I go ahead and read the above paragraph that Wiebe is referring to? For many years, the Jewish lawyer Selig acted as the responsible head of the Department for Theaters in the Prussian Ministry for Culture, whilst the Department for Music was in the hands of the Jew Leo Kestenberg. As the policy of the German press was controlled by Jews, indeed the supreme official administration was conducted by the Secretary of State Weizmann. It is easily possible to conjecture to what an extent the Jewish usurpation of the entire German intellectual life was officially sponsored and propagated. And then in the last paragraph, he says, this economic domination was the instrument to attain the practical application of their intellectual and cultural influence. So basically what you were saying, until they have the money, they really can't begin going after the culture. But once they have the power to print the currency of a nation, everything else will follow within generally a generation.
Adolf Hitler says on page 185 of Mein Kampf, for as long as the people remain racially pure and are conscious of the treasure of their blood, they can never be overcome by the Jew. Never in this world can the Jew become master of any people except a bastardized people. That is why the Jew systematically endeavors to lower the racial quality of a people by permanently adulterating the blood of the individuals who make up that people. In the field of politics, he now begins to replace the idea of democracy by introducing the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's what they did in Soviet Russia. And the masses organized under Marxist banners, he has found a weapon which makes it possible for him to discard democracy. That's what's going to happen here if they have their way. And we see it happening. We see it already in this Obama administration. Well, so as to subjugate and rule in a dictatorial fashion by the aid of brute force. Economically, he brings about the destruction of the state by a systematic method of sabotaging social enterprises until these become so costly, like the health care and the insurance industries in this country, until these become so costly that they are taken out of the hands of the state and then submitted to control of Jewish finance. And here they're doing the exact opposite of that. Politically, he works to withdraw from the state its means of subsistence, and as much as he undermines the foundations of national resistance and defense, destroys the confidence which the people have in a government, reviles the past and its history, and drags everything national down into the gutter. Culturally, his activity consists in boldlerizing, in destroying, I guess, or it's an odd word, boldlerizing art, perverting art, literature, and the theater, holding the expressions of national sentiment up to scorn, overturning all concepts of the sublime and beautiful, the worthy and the good, finally dragging the people to the level of his own low mentality. That's what he's done in the arts here. That's everything he's done in the arts here the last 40 years. And Hitler continues, of religion he makes a mockery. Morality and decency are described as antiquated prejudices, and thus a systematic attack is made to undermine those last foundations on which the national being must rest if the nation is to struggle for its existence in the world. So by getting control of our economic purse strings in 1913, and by becoming the banker of the nation, we've seen all these other things happen in this country. And Hitler talked about them, and Wiebe talked about them happening in Germany in World War I and in the Weimar Republic.
And if necessary, the Jew will do away with all pretenses of constitutional government in this country, won't he? If he was ever seriously threatened with an electoral defeat or some sort of political setback, it would be, you know, wham, bam, martial law, here we are.
Well, right, and that's what Hitler's talking about. You know, the Jew will get to the point where he uses democracy as a tool to get control, and then he disposes of democracy. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see that's the general sentiment with this Obama administration.
They use our institutions against us. They supplant our people. They usurp the power, and then they get rid of those institutions and create their own.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, everything about the nature, all the culture of the nation, through his control of finances, he's able to control the arts and the theater and destroy the culture of the nation.
Well, if we were a healthy, unified, homogeneous population with a strong sense of self, national worth, heritage, pride, and a sound moral culture of actual worthwhile achievement, the Jew would never be able to plant his destructive seed in this nation, would he?
And there's only one thing that explains how this same pattern happens in nation after nation that the Jew infests. The only thing that explains this is two-seed line Christian identity.
Mm.
Nothing else explains this. Nothing. And when your religion and history are one, then your religion must be true. It must be the true religion.
I know it's jumping ahead a bit, but there's a quote I'd like to read. The chief rabbi of Hamburg, Joseph Karlbach, wrote in Jewish Review, Der Morgen, Volume 2, page 129, 1930, quote, "To be a Jew is to be opposed to the natural attitude of human beings." That basically sums it up, what a Jew is.
Well, Paul of Tarsus said that the Jews were, they were in opposition to all people. You know, Paul pegged them, and this rabbi's agreeing with Paul of Tarsus about himself.
So a Jew is basically an aberration, isn't he? He's a creature that shouldn't exist. He's contrary to God and against nature.
Well, all bastards are contrary to God by their very existence. By their very creation, they're contrary to God. That's what Satan is. Satan is the adversary. Anything, you know, that law of kind after kind is mentioned 10 times at least in Genesis chapter 1.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first law of God, kind after kind. It's the first law of God we see, and it's mentioned again and again in Genesis chapter 1.
Well,
kind after kind, everything after its kind. Well, the Jew, by his very existence, and every alien, every bastard, is a violation of that law from his very conception. So anything that's in violation of that law is Satan.
I'm noticing some similarity between some things I've read in Russia number 1 that we're reading in Wiebe and that you've read from Mein Kampf, particularly that the Jews wish to destroy everything, all of the existing order. I'd like to read just one little sentence here out of Russia number 1, if that's all right.
Sure.
"I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war, which is still raging, and unless, as above stated, Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world, as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. Isn't that what the Jew always sets out to do? He finds a society, a new nation, an untapped reservoir. He moves in. The misguided people allow him in because they buy his sob story. And the next thing you know, he sets out over maybe a generation or two to destroy the existing way of life.
Well, right. We let massive amounts of Jews into this country in the 1880s because we bought the sob story that they were being oppressed in Russia and in Eastern Europe. The poor, oppressed Jews had to be let into the country. And by 1913, they controlled our economy. And then they brought upon us the Great Depression. And after they brought upon us the Great Depression, they owned half the country. They bought up half the country because they were the only ones that could get loans and money from their banker brothers who were inventing the money out of thin air.
And more than just that, they dragged us into two world wars that had nothing to do with our national interests or our interests as a race. And instead, indeed, they had us kill our own our cousins, our kith and kin overseas.
Well, an economic history of the United States in the 1940s, in the 30s and 40s, would prove the collusion in our entry into World War II with the Jews. Because we stayed in the Depression. Roosevelt's policies never got us out of the Depression. They made it worse in many instances.
Absolutely. The recession of 1936-1937, he deepened and prolonged the Great Depression. As we were finally starting to make a small recovery due to the hardworking efforts on the part of middle America, he wrecked things. He set back the progress that had been made.
As soon as we agreed to go to war against Germany, to do the will of the Jews to destroy the German people, there was plenty of money in this country for all of the manufacturing companies to start retooling for war and hiring employees to build war armaments. All of a sudden, overnight, there was plenty of money. Where'd it come from? It could have been there a few years ago. It could have been there in 1929. The Jews had absolute control over the issue of currency. That's the bottom line.
Thus, no money comes into existence that they don't desire or they don't will.
Absolutely. They kept us in that economic depression because they controlled how much currency was available and who was going to get it. Until we decided that we were going to collude with them in destroying Germany. And I mean, General Motors had plenty of money all of a sudden, and Ford had plenty of money to start building assembly plants for tanks and jeeps and trucks and everything else it took to build up the war armament overnight.
Hmm.
Overnight, we started building ships. Pearl Harbor was bombed, and we built a new Navy in a couple of years. We built a brand new Navy in a couple of years.
And we managed to build over 50,000 tanks, tens of thousands of aircraft, and they managed to equip, I think, 12-plus million soldiers.
Well, the economic history of the country proves that the Jews have ruled us by collusion. There's no doubt. If people would only open their eyes. They think depressions happen. Depressions don't happen. This current recession that we're in is planned.
It was well planned.
And it's going to stay. There's no recovery planned.
Well, I've said before that there is absolutely no recovery planned, and no recovery is possible because the same people are still at the helm who brought us to this point, and they did so by design, so they're not going to do anything that would take away from what they've achieved thus far. They're going to deepen and prolong this problem.
Well, the primary function of the Jew is to destroy Christianity. And if we don't think that that's true, then we're just idiots. We're just fooling ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I got to read this before the program's over. Page 199, Mein Kampf. The man who is not opposed and vilified and slandered in the Jewish press is not a staunch German, and he's not a true National Socialist. In other words, you're not doing your job if the press isn't vilifying you. The best rule whereby the sincerity of his convictions, his character, and strength of will can be measured is the hostility which his name arouses among the mortal enemies of our people. In other words, when a Jew hates you, you're a good German. The followers of the movement, and indeed the whole nation, must be reminded again and again of the fact that through the medium of his newspapers, the Jew is always spreading falsehood, and that if he tells the truth on some occasions, it is only for the purpose of masking some greater deceit, which turns the apparent truth into a deliberate falsehood. The Jew is the great master of lies. Isn't that what Jesus Christ said they were?
Ear of your father the devil, and the lust of your father ye will do.
He was a liar from the beginning.
And abode not in truth.
The Jew is the great master of lies, falsehood, and duplicity are the weapons with which he fights. Every calumny and falsehood published by the Jews are tokens of honor which can be worn by our comrades. He whom they decry most is nearest to our hearts, and he whom they mortally hate is our best friend.
Weren't we told that we would be hated throughout the world for his name's sake?
Absolutely. Adolf Hitler was a Christian. He knew absolutely what was going on, and he everything, all of his whole Weltanschauung comes from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
There is no doubt in my mind.
So where do these pagans, where do they think he got his Weltanschauung from? Do they think he just listened to Wagner and studied Odin?
Well, that's what they like us to believe. But his entire Weltanschauung is Christian. His whole outlook on life is Christian. And people that don't read the Bible will never see that. The National Socialists and these neo-Nazis, they'll never see that. Idiots like Arlene Johnson will never see that. She hasn't read the Bible. She talks a good game once in a while, but she hasn't read the Bible. And she'll never see that Hitler was a Christian. Because even if she read Mein Kampf, she would not be able to read she would not be able to understand the Christian precepts in it because she hasn't read the Bible.
I think she would be repulsed by it.
And the neo-Nazis can't see the Christian precepts in Mein Kampf because they don't read the Bible.
And for that matter, few of them read Mein Kampf.
Yeah, right. Hardly any of them actually read Mein Kampf. Right.
And I'd like to get in the literature here about this author, Emil Ludwig, real name Cohn.
Of course.
In his work about Jesus Christ, Ludwig even develops a frankly blasphemous tone. The title itself, The Son of Man, Der Menschensohn, Berlin, 1928, is a deliberate antithesis to the Christian conception of Christ as the Son of God. Ludwig's portrait consequently deprives the figure of Christ of all its religious attributes. What remains is a benevolent, rather sentimental type of person, hypnotized by a mission which has been foisted upon him by exterior influences. According to Ludwig, Christ's ideas and teachings are not at all new, but represent old Jewish religious doctrines already extolled by Philo and others. In his narratives of Christ's Sermon on the Mount, Ludwig says about Jesus' teachings, quote, his audience is not aware that Hillel, head of the Sanhedrin, taught the same ideas couched in practically the same words 50 years before, end quote. Should this passage not suffice to demonstrate Emil Ludwig's style, the following examples will no doubt convince they clearly show the methods Ludwig chose to create a blasphemous caricature of the Savior. Quote, also, wealthy citizens often invite him because he is learned in the Holy Scriptures and because of his reserved conduct. At such occasions, he wiles in their company and partakes of their wine. It is strong wine from the vineyards on the hills. He avoids neither festivities nor women, and he jests with the convives. He is also of cheerful disposition and does not scorn the pleasures of the table. When the women oint him or languorously listen to his words, his heart's yearning and dream of love are realized, and he, the prophet, lavishly distributes to many what the good man reserves for one alone, end quote. However, Ludwig goes still further and openly ridicules every Christian sentiment. According to his opinion, it was solely Judas the traitor who gave Jesus the necessary opportunity of fulfilling his mission of redemption. Quote, Judas wanted to force Jesus and his enemies to a decision. Only he who brought suffering upon the Master could open the gates of eternal splendor for him. If God wrought a miracle and granted that his son should finally be victorious, then the apparently faithless disciple Judas would be doubly justified.
You know
end
something
quote.
real quick. That, what you just said about Judas Iscariot and Christ,
mm-hmm.
is the exact same tone found in the so-called Gospel of Judas that was recently discovered amongst a Nag Hammadi manuscript. Well, a Gnostic manuscript.
Yes, and it's the exact same tone that I've heard on all History Channel religious documentaries on the ministry of Jesus, and it sounds exactly like what all the theological professors at my college were saying 2 and 3 years ago. That if it wasn't for Judas, Jesus' mission would have failed.
So, do the Jews, do they know somehow that they should defend their Canaanite brother? Do they know? Is there a deeper spiritual knowledge? I hate to say spiritual with the Jews, but we know it's an evil spirit. Is there a deeper spiritual awareness that these Jews have to know to defend Judas Iscariot? That somehow they know that they are devils just like he was, and that he's their brother, their Canaanite brother.
Well, Wiebe says, these words are the very quintessence of all impiety towards divine and human ideas, and shamelessly betray the most blatant cynicism, an eternal character trait of the Jewish race. And aren't the Jews an incredibly cynical people when it comes to the cultures and traditions of the host nations, but they're never cynical about themselves, are they?
And you know where the word cynic comes from?
Mm.
It comes from the Greek word kunos, which is dog. It does. A kunos is a bitch, generally.
Well, it's fitting that the Jews are dogs, since the woman of Canaan was referred to as a dog.
Absolutely. So they should be cynical.
And then, to quote Alfred Kerr, a friend of this Ludwig character, quote, "My friends, what is character? Very often just the opposite of the general conception, for our display of character is restricted to minutes." And then continued on, George Herrmann represented a somewhat different but by no means superior type of Jew, occupying a conspicuous position in the German literary world. In his political diary entitled Ranbemkungen, Marginal Notes, Berlin, 1919, he reveals the credo of a weak, utterly decadent man of literary ambitions, devoid of moral backbone and support. Quote, "As a Jew, I belong to a race much too old to be duped by mass suggestion. Such words as nation, war, and state are endowed with neither sound nor color for me. The cosmopolitan international mentality of Assauer's sons is clearly reflected in the following confession, quote, "I feel at home in any country of the world whose language I speak, where there are beautiful women, flowers and art, a good library, a chessboard, pleasant and cultivated society, and where the climate is healthy and agreeable and the landscape attractive," end quote. Nevertheless, Herrmann is honest enough to admit that the Jewish race is responsible for the dissemination of the negative attitude towards state and patriotism. He declares, quote, "The Jews' rejection of all nationalistic ideology is the principal source of his evolutionary quality and intrinsic value," end quote. He then goes on to say, 5 minutes of cowardice are preferable to being dead for the rest of one's days. Now, wouldn't that have to be the case for the Jew, though, since there's nothing waiting after them? There's nothing waiting for them after this.
They somehow know that this is all they have. It appears to me. They know that this is all they have, so they're going to get all they can while they're here. Because when they're over, just like the Apostle Jude said, they're clouds without water, and they're twice dead. And a cloud without water, to me, is a vessel without a soul. And being twice dead means that once you're dead spiritually, physically, you're dead spiritually also.
Mm.
And Christ called them whited sepulchres, beautiful on the outside but full of dead men's bones. That's it. That's all they have inside them.
And they're not even beautiful on the outside, though.
Well, you know, they put themselves up to be.
Yes. And then a quote from a Jew, Lessing, in his book Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, Berlin, 1929, which is solely dedicated to the calumniation of his native country. He cynically vaunts, "What these judges term high treason is no concern of ours and can be estimated as an honorable action in our eyes." So here's a Jew who says that treason is honorable.
Treason is honorable. But can a Jew commit treason? That's a philosophical. I mean, treason is somebody turning on their own nation. And a Jew that's a German really isn't a German. He's still a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a Jew in your country, you deserve to have him turn on you. That's the way
Absolutely.
I look at it. You have to understand that they're opposed to you right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if I call it treason, but yeah, they glory in it. They define it that way, and they glory in it. There's no doubt.
Mm-hmm. Is it all right if we skip ahead a page and get into cinema?
Yeah, fine, because I don't. You might have more to contribute than I in this realm.
Oh,
now,
I have
I'll
a lot
it.
To say.
I'll read it and you comment on it.
Okay.
To an even greater degree than in the sphere of the theater, which the Jews do control on Broadway here, by the way. The Jews had swooped down upon the whole film industry during the years before 1933. Now, as an aside, that's the same time they took over the American film industry.
Mm-hmm.
This fact is easy to explain inasmuch as financial and artistic factors are more intricately related in this branch of art than in any other. The profits derived in the film industry considerably exceed those of any other artistic enterprises. The possibility of realizing tremendous earnings naturally induced the Jews to invade the German film industry, which had begun to flourish during the years following the war, meaning World War I. The enormous Jewish participation in the film branch is demonstrated by the following figures. In 1931, 41 firms of the 67 German film producers were in Jewish hands. That is to say 61%. Of 28 distributors, 24 were Jewish. That is 86%. During the same period, 119 of the 144 film manuscripts were written by Jews, 82%. Yeah, you know, quite often, I'm going to make another aside, quite often I tell people that I won't watch movies because I don't want to waste my time watching some Jew's sick fantasy.
Well,
in 77 cases, the staging was carried out by Jews, which is 53%. If one examines the names of the producers, directors, and film stars which participated in those films which were enthusiastically praised by the press, and they used their press to praise their movies, and which developed into box office successes, one will invariably discover that the great majority were Jewish. Amongst the producers and distributors we find Pressburger and Rabinowitz, Heyman, Fallner, Sonlo, Levi, or Cohn. The directors were Oswald Ornstein, Zelnick, Meinhardt, Neufeld, or Schoenfelder. The actors Pallenberg, Siegfried, Arno, Fritz Wahlberg, Felix Bressart, Kurt Garone, Greit Mosheim, Gita Alpar, Rosa Valetti. He's naming all Jews. I mean, we don't recognize all those names immediately.
It's an invitation list to a bar mitzvah.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to point out this one, you know, it's basically, in my opinion, the most prominent example to come out of Germany in regards to movies that undermine a culture and attack values crucial to a people. The movie M by Fritz Lang, starring Peter Lorre, better known by his birth name Laszlo Lowenstein, where they extol the virtues of a child-killing pedophile who was captured by a group of outraged citizens and dragged before a citizens' vigilante court. And they're trying to tell him that he has to answer for his crimes, and he first denies it. Then he starts to scream that he's insane and he needs help, and they don't know what it's like to be him. He screams that he's compelled to murder and he must do it, and the only time he gets relief from the pain is when he kills children, and that he's not to blame because he's not responsible for his actions. He commits the murder and wakes up a day later and sees the missing poster and wonders, did I do that? And he then goes on to tell them that, you know, the judge of the citizens' court, aren't you wanted for manslaughter, and aren't you a safe cracker? Don't you play dice games? He goes on to point at all these people and tell them, oh, you sell alcohol on the Sabbath, and you've done this, and you've done that. And he tries to gloss over his own crime, murdering children, dozens of them, by pointing out these people have engaged in very petty offenses by comparison. Then he demands to be handed over to the police so he can be helped. He demands that they hand him over to a court of common law, and the people are getting ready to kill him, but the police intervene. They take him to a court, and the court is getting ready to sentence him, and then they cut to the mothers, and the mothers say, it doesn't matter what they sentence him with, our children will never be brought back. We should have kept a better eye on them. Thus, we're led to believe that the victim is at fault for not keeping, you know, the mothers let the children play in their front yard. as though somehow that's irresponsible. How dare you let your child play in your front yard? You should have known better.
Right, that's the Jewish tag, is always to normalize deviant behavior by blaming the victims.
Mm-hmm. And they make us believe that. They make us believe that this child killer can get some help, where, as I said to my dad, the only thing he needs is a .45 caliber pep pill.
Well, the only thing that solves pedophilia is castration from the neck down. From the neck down, that permanently solves it.
Or give them a 12-gauge tranquilizer.
Absolutely. Yeah, that sums up the problem with America today, with our culture. It is that we've accepted the Jew, and he's been the perverter of everything good.
And they ridicule the mob. They portray them as vigilantes who are out for blood, when really they're victims out for justice.
Adolf Hitler complains about the German people and their hostility towards their own kith and kin, their own native land and home, was as irrational as it was comprehensible. It was against nature, and he explains how that came from the programming of the masses from the press. He calls them evil spirits leading our people astray. And that's exactly what they are. And that's another biblical allusion. The sickness in our society is from acceptance of the enemies of God. And this is the inevitable result. And it was the inevitable result that the German people accepted the enemies of God through the 18 and early 1900s. And what happened to Germany was the inevitable result.
Well, even Wagner, who these people point to as inspiration for Hitler, Wagner said, quote, "The Jew is the demon behind the corruption of mankind."
Absolutely.
That sounds like a scriptural concept.
He probably understood his Bible, too, because once upon a time, some white men read their Bibles.
And once upon a time, people didn't allow the Jews to pander. They were kept under check.
Absolutely. I agree.
I'd like to continue on with Wiebe. "The mentality typical of the entire Jewish film industry is displayed in the crudest form by the so-called social and hygienic instruction films, a type of film with which the German cinemas were veritably flooded during the years after the war. Officially, they were intended to acquaint the masses with the dangers of abnormal sexual intercourse and debauch. They were based on a pseudo-scientific foundation, and under this mask, Jewish capital speculated upon the primitive erotic desires and the lowest instincts of the public. Criminals, prostitutes, and the pathologically abnormal were the heroes of this category of film. A choice of titles taken at random from the legion of such so-called instructive films will give the best idea of their type and value. Quote, Morals and Erotic. Quote, The Book of Sin. Quote, What Price for Love? Quote, Culpable Mothers. Quote, Prostitution. Quote, When Women Go Astray. The contents harmonized with these seductive titles, which gave rise to the considerable expectations on the part of the public, which were by no means deceived. These films veritably wallowed in mire and filth, and with the most cynical openness, reproduced scenes actually showing the most repulsive debauchery and perversion." And at this point, I would like to discuss the movie The Last Orgy of the Gestapo in this country. It was produced in Italy, I believe, in the late 60s, early 70s. Do you know much about the movie? I think you read the blurb I sent you.
No, I don't know much about the movie, no.
Well, I've never seen it, of course, and I don't really want to read paragraph from paragraph describing the plot line, since there are women listening. Suffice to say, the premise is that a Holocaust survivor returns to the camp where she was held, and the commandant is there, and they immediately begin doing things. And
when did she return? That's what I want to know. Was this after the war that she returned to the camp?
Yes.
Well, then why wasn't the commandant hung at Nuremberg?
That's a question the movie doesn't explore.
Okay, I just saw that problem with the plot line, and I guess that proves the Jews don't really care about history, do they?
And then it gets into issues of sodomy, torture, women sodomize the commandant with his own whip, And then they're jealous because he went with a Jewish woman instead of them. Rats eat several women alive while men stand by watching, doing things to themselves. And it was supposedly by an Italian, Cesare Cain Verri. And that doesn't sound like an Italian name to me, Cain Verri. He has the word Cain in his name. It sounds like he's subtly trying to let us know who and what he is.
Well, that's like a Solomon Perez in Brazil. You know, I mean, he's definitely a Jew. Cain isn't an Italian name the last time I checked.
And it doesn't sound like something that sprang from the mind of an Italian, does it?
No. The Jews, there's no doubt they're responsible for 90% of the pornography. And it's probably higher than that.
And then at the end, the survivor gets pregnant by the commandant. He declares that she's not worthy to carry his child, and he doesn't want a half-Jewish baby in the world, so he forces her to undergo an abortion, and then she kills him.
Well, that's abortion's another Jewish facet of a perfect Jewish world.
Have you ever known a white Christian to force a Jew to undergo an abortion? Isn't it usually the other way around?
It's funny. White Christians will hate their own family before they force an alien to have an abortion. It's absolutely true.
But I mean, that's all I really want to discuss about that movie, since we just can't. I can't in good conscience.
Well, there's 10,000 movies like that in America. And when was the censorship board that oversaw Hollywood disbanded? And was it in the 60s? I honestly don't know, because I just don't pay any attention to Hollywood.
Censorship board. I honestly don't know either. I would have to guess.
Central Board of Film Certification. Government. Well, that's not even American. They're out of their minds. Okay.
I think it's safe to say it would be gone by the early 60s, but that movie, I just found out that one we were talking about came out in 1977.
Well, right. I was, it wasn't long after the censorship board in this country was done away with that we got nothing but smut in movies, and it was straight downhill from there.
It might be, I want to say, 1968.
Okay.
Although that seems a bit late.
That seems late, but that's very plausible. When I was a little boy, I watched movies and I never saw girls with their clothes off, people doing perverted things and debauchery and that.
When did
1968 is probably the year that Linda Lovelace made it big, eh?
I was going to ask. Oh, here we go. Prior to 1968, some large cities and states had public rating boards which determined whether films were suitable for display to the public in theaters. The United States Supreme Court, in the case of Friedman versus Maryland, 1965,
Friedman,
effectively ended government-operated rating boards when it decided that a rating board could only approve a film. It had no power to ban a film.
Did you say Friedman versus Maryland?
Friedman versus Maryland.
You think Friedman was a Christian?
Oh, I have my doubts.
I just had to mention that. That was actually, he was an agent for United Artists, according to what I have in front of me right now. I thought it was a national censor. It looks like there were state censorship boards. But I know that as soon as they disbanded, as soon as they stopped that practice, that Hollywood went straight downhill, and it's been a race to the bottom ever since.
Well, one of my notes here I scribbled down, the white race has been royally duped by the Jew, who panders to the basis of instincts and physical desires. And they cultivate an unrealistic image of the human body, don't they?
Well, they cultivate an unrealistic image of everything. Everything they do is macabre.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they try to do something right, it's macabre. It's not right.
I think we should talk about the reviews.
Well, isn't that like the equivalent of vaudeville?
Vaudeville
was
yes.
In the 20s? And they were all Jews.
I'd like to read some of the titles of the Jewish vaudeville equivalent, of the Jewish equivalent to vaudeville.
Well, right.
Quote,
it seems like Germany in Victorian age, when I say Victorian age, I mean the late 1800s, that in Germany they had no laws governing any of that at all, because the Jews seem to have gotten away with everything. And once you read these names of these reviews, people will realize that.
The loud and vulgar titles given to these reviews, for which enormous propaganda was made, speak for themselves. The following translations give an impression of what was presented to the public. Title number 1, Undress Yourselves. Title number 2, 1,000 Naked Women. Title 3, The Sins of the World. Title 4, House of Lust. Title 5, Strictly Prohibited. Title 6, OG, 1,000 Pretty Girls. Title 7, Sweet and Sinful. The advertisements for James Klein's reviews on Dress Yourselves were deliberately designed to awaken the lowest instincts of a public by enticing it with the following enumeration. Quote, an evening without morals and principles, 60 nude models, winners of beauty prizes, the adventures of beautiful women, experiences with a girl of 15, end quote. My remark here is that Jews seem fascinated by underage girls, and for that matter, boys, because the Talmud teaches both pedophilia and homosexuality.
I was going to say that the Talmud's also, their religious book is fascinated with with sex with children. That's what Jews do. They pervert children and they corrupt everything they get their greasy hands on.
And the posters advertising the review, 1,000 Naked Women, announced, quote, the grand review of free love, 40 pictures of morality and immorality. End quote. And Jewikipedia says that reviews, as they're called in America, consisted mostly of the same. For between 15 cents and 25 cents, citizens could observe productions from Florence Ziegfeld or the Schubert brothers or many others.
Well,
they were
tame compared to these.
But they were all typified by what Jewikipedia describes as, quote, and these are their words now, not mine, the frank display of the female body, end quote.
Yeah, but the Siegfried brothers and things like that were very tame compared to some of these things that Wiebes describes here.
Did you say Siegfried? Ziegfeld.
Ziegfeld, yeah, I'm sorry. It's a famous name, but the less I pay attention to the Jewish entertainment industry, the happier I am.
True.
The more I avoid it, the happier I am. That's why I haven't seen a movie in 15 years, and I don't plan on seeing one anytime. So I'm sorry I lied. I watched Profane's 9/11 Missing Links. That's the only
that
movie
really
I
mo-
can say I've seen in 15 years.
Is that really a movie so much as it is an academic presentation?
Yeah, right. It's an academic presentation, but I'm just making a joke, really.
Okay.
We have this term free love used by Wiebe here in the 1930s. And we see it coming from Jewish reviews. So where did the free love of the 1960s come from? Where did that campaign start? It absolutely started with Jews. But it looks like Germany got the disease about 30 or 40 years sooner than we did.
But there were women in this country talking free love in 1840 and 1860.
Yeah, well, all I'm trying to say is that this has been a campaign against decency for 100 years. It's not something that just exploded in the 1960s, which is the way most people perceive it.
Yes, this campaign against decency has been going on since the Garden of Eden.
Well, yes, we understand that.
Yet some people think it's a new invention, it's modern.
Right, and that's what I'm trying to say. And even Tacitus in the first century wrote about the Romans that they performed every kind of indecency and called it modern and called it up to date. And I have that quote somewhere in Tacitus in the histories. He actually said that. So sexual deviancy or sexual debauchery in the name of modernity is a 2,000-year-old idea, at least, eh? That's incredible that we keep getting tricked by the same Satan keeps tricking us over and over again.
With the same trick.
With the same trick, right. Exactly.
It's like somebody asks to borrow your baseball bat, and then they hit you with it as soon as you hand it to them. How many times are you going to loan him your baseball bat?
Yeah.
All right, the Jewish share in immorality.
Shall I begin?
I think that we should probably save this for next week because we have a whole thing on the Jews and crime to get into, too, which is very important to understand.
All right. So I should go ahead and stop the recording right now, then?
Well, I hate to spoil the party, but it's just about 2 hours, and to start a new section at this time would be we'd only have to repeat it next week.
Do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to get out?
No, I think we did a good job at explaining that the problems in Germany with the Jewish press, with the Jewish entertainment industry, are the same problems that we've faced here the last 50 years, but the Germans faced them a long time before we did. And people in Germany, and with Adolf Hitler as their leader, of course, they stood against this, and that's why the Jews beckoned us to destroy Germany.
They couldn't countenance Germany standing, could they?
They couldn't countenance a proper Christian society. And they've polluted this country, and nobody stood up. Nobody has stood up. We've had nobody stand up to them.
And Hitler said, it is not enough to simply declare, I believe, but rather you must make the affirmation, I fight.
Absolutely.
In this country, sadly, not too many people are fighting what the Jews are doing.
Nobody stands up to them. All of these modern evangelical TV preachers teach about personal wealth and salvation, and let the Jew commit all the sins that he wants, and Hollywood spew all the sins out that he wants. Everybody that even is put up to make it look like they're standing up to him is marginalized and ridiculed, and people go along with it. And when the newspaper ridicules a leader that makes an earnest attempt at making a moral stand, the damn shame is that people still buy that newspaper, that Christians still buy that newspaper, or Christians still watch that TV. You know, NBC could knock the hell out of Christianity 5 days a week. And on Saturday and Sunday, you'll see all these Baptists watching football games on NBC. It's incredible that nobody cares. Nobody cares about anything except bread and circuses.
Don't you know the Jews are God's chosen people and we're all going to be raptured? You don't have to worry about anything. Just kick back and enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible.
Now, people should wonder, why would this mentality come about, or how would it come about, and who would cultivate it, and why? Why would society adopt this couch potato mentality, and who would push it? Who benefits from society being comprised of couch potatoes, those who want to control society?
Well, that's what they've done, and our Christian nation has let it happen. Okay, I'm done. I've said plenty tonight.
All right. Well, praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh, and I'll be here tomorrow night. I'll be on Chris Degeni tomorrow night for an open forum, and maybe I'll see you all there. And thank you, people.
What time will that be?
10 p.m. It's on the announcements page at Chris Degeni.
Okay, great. Yahweh bless. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Praise Yahweh.